It's Tyler.
America loves a good sex scandal.
Elliot Spitzer is indeed client nine.
Find out Kristen Stewart was cheating on Robert Pattinson.
In fact, America loves a bad sex scandal.
Anthony Weiner now admits he sent additional explicit photos and texts to a woman.
Monica Lewinsky is back in the news this month with an essay telling her side of the biggest American sex scandal of my lifetime.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
But as long ago as 1998 seems, Bill and Monica did not invent the sex scandal. A century and a half earlier, Hester Prynne and the Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale, characters in Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel The Scarlet Letter, set the standard for American adultery. WNYC's Anna Sale takes us into this American icon.
The Scarlet Letter opens with Hester Prynne stepping out of prison to a crowd of gawking townspeople. She's young, she's beautiful, and she has a baby in her arms.
Hester Prynne, you have been found guilty of adultery. We are loath to invoke the full penalty of the law.
This is from a 1934 movie version.
So if you would have us be merciful, reveal the name of him that tempted you.
No.
She gets a life sentence of shame. The Scarlet Letter was published in 1850, but it's still there, everywhere, in any conversation about sex, illicit desire, and humiliation. And it's one of those references you can throw around for literary cred, like in this Taylor Swift song that mashes together Hawthorne and Shakespeare. It's shown up on The Simpsons and Roseanne. There was a modern riff with Emma Stone as a high schooler with a bad reputation. It was also on Twin Peaks.
Hester Prynne, pretty name.
During the interrogation of a prostitute.
I read The Scarlet Letter in high school just like you did.
I read it like most of American teenagers in a high school English class.
Tom Perrott is the author of a number of novels about sex and sexual politics in suburbia. Election, The Abstinence Teacher, Little Children. He hadn't read the book since he was a teenager, but he picked it up again before we spoke.
I actually loved it this time. It's a little bit unhinged, and I feel like they're just these unruly sexual energies that the book is like really struggling to keep clamped down. And I think I just clamped them down enough that as a teenager, I miss that. And as an adult, I see it and was really struck by the kind of contained craziness of it.
I remember feeling like it was weirdly sexy. I remember feeling sort of feminist about it.
Lindy West is a staff writer at Jezebel.
It's a very clear demonstration of the arbitrariness of a lot of morality and the way that that disproportionately affects women. So I remember feeling as a woman that this was something I should be paying attention to.
It's about a single mother. I mean, what could be more relevant, really?
Brenda Wineapple is the author of a biography of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
She's what they used to call a fallen woman.
Fallen, and she's kind of proud of it.
She took the baby on her arm, and with a burning blush and yet a haughty smile and a glance that would not be abashed, looked around at her townspeople and neighbors. On the breast of her gown, in fine red cloth, surrounded with an elaborate embroidery and fantastic flourishes of gold thread, appeared the letter A.
That's a kind of shocking image, I think. And then it becomes about what that means to her, what that means to her child, what that means to her lover, what it means to her husband, what it means to the community. And there are all these very different points of view about what that means, and they kind of change over time.
So the sin is out there, but what Hester won't reveal is the father's name.
I will not speak, answered Hester, turning pale as death, but responding to this voice, which she too surely recognized. And my child must seek a heavenly father. She shall never know an earthly one.
But the reader knows. It's the town minister, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. He's there at Hester's sentencing. Publicly, he urges her to name the father. Privately, he's a mess.
Arthur Dimmesdale, sodden with guilt.
That's Peter Coviello. He teaches English at Bowdoin College, and he's written about sex in 19th century literature.
Just Hawthorne's great expression of someone just riven by a kind of self-horror that he can't work out. And preyed on and preyed upon.
The person preying upon Dimmesdale is the other man in the book, Roger Chillingworth. He's Hester's husband, a much older man. He arrives in town to find Hester with her illegitimate baby. He pretends to be a physician and discovers Dimmesdale is the father. But he doesn't let on. Instead, Chillingworth manipulates Dimmesdale's insecurities to deepen his shame.
As he proceeded, a terrible fascination, a kind of fierce, though still calm, necessity seized the old man within its grip and never set him free again until he had done all its bidding. He now dug into the poor clergyman's heart like a miner searching for gold, or rather, like a sexton delving into a grave.
That love triangle between Hester Prynne, Arthur Dimmesdale, and Roger Chillingworth pulses through the romantic text.
Sex is always there. There's a kind of erotic overtone or undertone with Chillingworth and Dimmesdale.
This is a super queer book. The erotics of Chillingworth's really outsized and impassioned investment in Dimmesdale and his destruction is, in certain ways, the larger romance of the book.
Where it's not clear really who's after who and who's interested in whom, and that's all eroticized as well. Very sexy.
Like on the night the three come across each other in town, and a meteor flashes across the sky.
If the meteor kindled up the sky and disclosed the earth with an awfulness that admonished Hester Prynne and the clergyman of the Day of Judgment, then might Roger Chillingworth have passed with them for the arch-fiend, standing there with a smile and scowl to claim his own. So vivid was the expression, or so intense the minister's perception of it, that it seemed still to remain painted on the darkness after the meteor had vanished.
The Scarlet Letter has that sense of the claustrophobia of a small town, the sense of being watched by people you know all the time. Hawthorne knew that feeling. He was living in his hometown, Salem, where one of his ancestors was a judge at the Salem witch trials. So the Puritans were on Hawthorne's mind, even as some modern ideas about women were starting to take shape. Hawthorne biographer Brenda Wineapple says Hawthorne was right in the middle of it.
For a while, one of his very close friends was a very strong and sexual and outspoken woman named Margaret Fuller.
Fuller was a pioneer of what came to be feminism. She wrote a book that inspired the landmark Seneca Falls Conference on Women's Rights, which happened just before The Scarlet Letter was published. But to tell his story about a woman exploring the boundaries of personal freedom, Hawthorne looked back all the way to the 1600s.
Somehow those present issues became more real for him and more exciting if they were projected past.
Out of all this, Hawthorne created Hester Prynne.
She has no precedent. There is no American literature. There is no American heroine before her.
And Hawthorne had conflicted feelings about Hester.
She's forced into a position of infamy because she's pregnant, because she's an unwed mother, because she had to tryst in the woods with a minister. Not a good thing. And yet at the same time, she chose to go.
It's a strange book. It can't deal with sex, and yet it's creating the groundwork for a sexual revolution.
Again, novelist Tom Perotta.
I think the thing that makes it so American, and is the thing that makes it modern too, though it's hard to see that, is that the real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy. And I think that's a specific American view of sex.
The Scarlet Letter's sexiest scene comes when Hester Prynne and Arthur Dimmesdale meet again, this time away from Chillingworth's watchful eye. Hester and Pearl are on a walk, and the child runs ahead. That's when Hester sees Reverend Dimmesdale walk past her, and she calls to him.
So strangely did they meet in the dim wood that it was like the first encounter in the world beyond the grave of two spirits who had been intimately connected in their former life, but now stood coldly shuddering in mutual dread.
The one-time lovers, at first, have no idea what to say to each other.
When they found voice to speak, it was, at first, only to utter remarks and inquiries such as any two acquaintances might have made about the gloomy sky, the threatening storm, and, next, the health of each. Thus they went onward, not boldly, but step by step, into the themes that were brooding deepest in their hearts.
Hester reveals to Dimmesdale that his friend Chillingworth is her husband. Dimmesdale decides to leave town, and Hester says she'll go with him. They'll flee, start a new life together, and live happily ever after. And then the scene that the late novelist John Updike called one of the great moments in American fiction in an interview with NPR a year before he died.
First, she throws away the scarlet letter.
Hester tosses the scarlet A aside.
Oh, exquisite relief. She had not known the weight until she felt the freedom. By another impulse, she took off the formal cap that confined her hair, and down it fell upon her shoulders, dark and rich, with at once a shadow and a light in its abundance, and imparting the charm of softness to her features.
How wonderful the power of the hair, the mystery of the long hair let down.
John Updike wrote a trilogy based on The Scarlet Letter, each book retold from the perspective of one of the major characters. His 1988 book S is from Hester's point of view.
She's such an arresting and slightly ambiguous figure. She's a funny mix of a truly liberated, defiantly sexual and independent woman, but in the end, a woman who accepts the penance that society imposed on her. I suppose she's an epitome of female predicaments.
You know the female predicaments, the questions about how to get what you want within a tangle of obligations and expectations. Hester wants to be with her lover, and she loves him by protecting him. Those predicaments are still here, says Lindy West of Jezebel.
We're still dealing with these issues now, and this was something that Hawthorne was criticizing in the mid-19th century. That's pretty discouraging, actually.
And that's why the term scarlet letter is still ubiquitous.
I guess we use it as a shorthand for what we call slut-shaming now, which is blaming women for their own sexuality and turning that into a moral failing.
Lindy West pays a lot of attention to the contradictions in how people talk about women and sex on the internet. On the one hand, she says there's consensus that it's okay for American women to have sex lives. But if you want to condemn or humiliate a woman, go online and point out she has a sex life.
There are so many outlets to shame people for their behavior, to post pictures, naked pictures, or post details of people's personal lives that they don't want shared. It makes the stakes higher for everyone because it's not just hearsay anymore. People can bring up actual evidence. But on the flip side of that, the internet's also amazing in terms of women finding solace in community. I mean, Hester Prynne would probably have loved having a Tumblr. I mean, I think that could have really helped her out.
And the internet can also be a tool of revenge. Lindy West has become a kind of watchdog, and she brings a certain level of glee to taking on digital bullies.
People have figured out that we can use the same tactics to shame the shamers. If they say something horrible to me, I will retweet it with their face attached to it, and then all of my hilarious female friends will make fun of them. I mean, I will crush them.
Almost like Roger Chillingworth wanted to crush Arthur Dimmesdale.
Now I'm confused. Because isn't he the villain? Well, anyway, I guess I do. I am fueled by revenge. But my revenge is justified because they started it.
Hester Prynne may still be our archetype for a woman acting on her desires. But in the end, she doesn't get what she wants. Dimmesdale just can't follow through on their plans to flee together.
And of course, he can't do it. I mean, he's the same man he always was, and he was never able to be strong. But I think that Hawthorne is saying that's not a great thing to do anyway, because that would be another shirking of a kind of responsibility. These people have a responsibility to the community. They can't just take off.
When Tom Perata was writing his novel Little Children, he retold that story.
I suddenly realized, you know, there's a scene in Little Children where the adulterous lovers are on a football field and they commit to running away together.
Run away with me.
This is from the movie version.
What?
Starring Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson.
You don't mean that.
You believe in me.
But, you know, they have to make some arrangements. And, of course, in the intervening space, the man loses heart and finds that the courage leaks away. And so it really is a kind of clear reference back to this scene in The Scarlet Letter that I thought I had forgotten. But I think it's that kind of book. It becomes part of America's collective unconscious and certainly American novelists' unconscious.
In The Scarlet Letter, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale does eventually confess his sins and promptly dies of a heart attack. Hester and Pearl leave town. But at the end of the book, Hester returns. She lives out her life there, becoming a kind of advisor to local women, talking about their troubles and love. All the while, she wears the Scarlet A.
In the lapse of the toilsome, thoughtful, and self-devoted years that made up Hester's life, the Scarlet Letter ceased to be a stigma which attracted the world's scorn and bitterness, and became a type of something to be sorrowed over, and looked upon with awe, yet with reverence too.
Hester is buried next to Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. This book is all about the tension between public shaming and public accountability. Nathaniel Hawthorne intimately details the inner lives of the transgressors and the enforcers, their individual motivations and hurts. But he's never totally clear on how he feels about the transgression. In this drama that centers on community judgments, Hawthorne withholds his.
I think the frustrating part of him is what's the wonderful part of him, and that is he's very brilliant, and he won't take a stand.
Hawthorne has a lot of stuff that's disquieting. He just kind of holds out here. This is discomforting and unsettling. Let's look at it for a while.
It's our anxiety. He induces anxiety in us, and we want to keep coming back and trying to understand.
I've been loving you.
For Studio 360, I'm Anna Sale.
A little too long. I don't want to stop now.
You can hear a longer version of Anna Sale's conversation with the novelist Tom Perotta at studio360.org. Excerpts from The Scarlet Letter were read for us by Amanda Quaid. And for more from Anna Sale on the things we don't talk about in polite conversation, check out her new regular podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. You can find it at wnyc.org.